Pyramid Podcast, where three lads discuss all things the English football pyramid. I'm your host, Alex Murphy, and once again, I'm joined by Tom Gallagher and Tom Lawrence, and we're joined by a very special guest, former Brighton, Exeter, Celtic, Coventry, Colchester, the mighty Yeovil Town, Bristol Rovers, and now turned TV pundit, Adam Virgo. Adam, welcome to the show, mate. Let's start at the beginning. Tell us about your rise into the pro game and signing a contract with your boyhood club, Brighton.
Yeah, I mean, the pro game, the academy system now is night and day from when I was going through the system. The system was very much Sunday league football, and you weren't really being scouted till you're about maybe 14 or 15. So I played for my local clubs, Hollenbury Hawks, where I grew up in Brighton, and then played for a couple of other teams afterwards. But it wasn't until I was about 16 when I was at school, where Martin Hinchelwood, who was the head of the Brighton development, came into our school and was coaching our school because we got to a finals of a major competition for my old college. And he took a liking to me and kind of saw something in me, which was really, really good. And he was the one really who kind of gave me my opportunity and gave me my chance in the program. But there wasn't, I wouldn't say, a list of clubs that were knocking on the door. It didn't really happen much back then, but Brighton, fortunately, were a club that took some interest in me. And he's got a great nephew who's Jack Hinchelwood, who's now at Brighton playing right back. So I played with his nephew as well, Adam, who's now the manager of York. So that's kind of how I got into the pro game. And Mickey Adams was a manager that took a liking to me and gave me my first opportunity.
Who else was at Brighton with you at the time, Adam? Because obviously, they're a big Premier League club now, but looking back, obviously, like Murph's alluded to, we're all from Yeovil, we're Yeovil fans. So I always think about Brighton back in our younger years of being more of an EFL club, probably between Championship and League Two. What sort of players? Was it like the Bobby Zamora years you were there, that kind of era?
Yeah. So I joined in 2000 and Bobby was just signed from Bristol Rovers and he was an unknown quantity then. But once you'd played with him and trained with him, you kind of knew that this player wasn't going to be with us for too long. And we were lucky to have him for three seasons. I played with players like Richard Carpenter and Nathan Jones, who's now the manager of Charlton, former Yeovil player. I played with Ben Roberts. So there's a few ex-Yeovil players there. But Bobby's probably the main player. And then in my second stint, I was with like Glenn Murray, Nicky Forster, those kind of players. But the early parts of my years, Bobby was a massive influence in terms of the goals that he scored and the success that we had as a team.
Like you've scored quite a lot of goals as a defender. I mean, I remember when you were at Yeovil, you're the only defender I can remember ever taking penalties for us. You scored a few for Brighton as well. Were they all penalties, or were you a marauding centre back in your younger days and used to get in the box and score from anywhere?
Yeah, it was mostly with my head more than my feet. And that's why I was quite surprised that I ended up being a penalty taker. The penalty one at Yeovil happened because we played Southampton and we didn't actually have a penalty taker. And that was the problem. And I just said, well, I'll take it. And I remember taking it. And then I managed to get, I think, five more after that, which was quite lucky, apart from the one at Leyton Orient that I didn't get. I got taken off me by Sean McDonald. But that was really it. But a lot of my goals were mainly from my head, just trying to get on the end of it from a corner or a cross. But the penalties really only started happening when I joined Yeovil.
Who was the striker at Yeovil that season who's looking at the floor when there's a penalty against Southampton? Would it have been Dean Bowditch? Would he have been there that season?
Yeah, there was Dean. Who else would there have been? Andy Welsh was another one. I wouldn't have trusted Nathan Smith with a penalty or Craig Alcott at the time. But it was weird. It was just one of those things that we didn't, it sounds silly, but we didn't actually have one. And I just said, I'll take it. And thankfully scored. And once you score one, then you've got an opportunity of scoring goals. But yeah, Dean Bowditch was really good that season for us and got a move quite rightly so afterwards.
I remember the Southampton penalty. I was right behind the goal. And we'll come on and speak about Yeovil, obviously, from being around, we've got loads to speak to you about that. But I wanted to, the reason I asked about the goals is because you got quite what I would say seems like a massive move to Celtic for apparently 1.5 million. What was it about your time at Brighton that attracted Celtic to you and sort of made them part with that kind of money? Because back in 2005, that would have been quite a lot for a centre-back from Brighton to go up to Celtic. Big move for you. Were you flying at Brighton at the time?
Yeah, I had a period when I first came into the first team, when I first got to Brighton, and I was really excelling. And I'm not, you know, I was getting good coverage, and then we won League Two, we won League One, and then we got into the Championship. Mickey Adams, who was my manager, he left. Peter Taylor came in, who was my other manager, who really liked me. He then left. And then Steve Coppell came in, and Martin Hinchelwood, the guy that gave me the opportunity, he was manager for like 13 games, got the sack, and then Steve Coppell came in. And Steve just went with the experience, and I didn't really get a look in after that. And that's when I went down to Exeter on loan for a couple of months just to play some football. And then Mark McGee came in around January time of 2003, I think it was. And then I had a really good 6 months, scored a really, really important goal against Swindon that got us to a final against Bristol City. We then go into the Championship where I score 9 goals that season. I end up being a centre forwards that season, playing in every position. But during that time, Gordon Strachan had taken a sabbatical from football, and Gordon and Mark were quite good friends. So Gordon had seen a lot of me, come to a lot of Brighton games. So he hadn't been scouting me for his next club. He just, from what I've heard and speaking to him, he had seen a lot of me during that time. And then when I finished that season at Brighton in 2005, I was flying. I was on a really good run, and I had quite a few clubs interested in me in that season, but Celtic being the obvious one, the biggest one by far, was always going to be a very, very difficult opportunity to turn down at that stage.
Within that Celtic sort of squad, I'm guessing they were part of European honours at the time, like going in the European competitions. Did you have a chance to experience like an Old Firm game, and what was the team like up in Celtic?
Yeah, I mean, the team was phenomenal. And I actually said no to Celtic twice before I left. And one of the reasons I said no was because when I looked at the squad of players, and it wasn't, I'd always back myself, but a lot of that squad was still the squad that I'd seen a year and a half previously against Porto when they lost to Jose Mourinho's side. The only two players that were missing were Paul Lambert and Henrik Larsson, but John Hartson was still there, Stylian Petrov was there, Neil Lennon was there, Boba Balde was there, Alan Thompson was there. We'd signed Artur Boric, who turned out to be a fantastic goalkeeper. We signed a Japanese boy called Tsunsuke Nakamura, who, if you go on YouTube and see his free kick against Manchester United in the Champions League, the levels were there. And then you've got other players that, you know, many may not have heard of, Aidan McGeady, Sean Maloney, Sean Pearce, Stephen Pearson, you know, really, really, really good players at that stage, really. So it was a massive move. But I made my debut for Celtic against Rangers at Rangers, which was, you know, an experience that I'll never forget. A massive game, even though we lost that day, it was something that I will never forget. And going forward, and it's the biggest derby in world football. I can quite easily say that. I know there's ones in Turkey, maybe a couple in South America, but that derby there is something that it takes some beating. And, you know, when religion's involved and things like that, it kind of takes on a different way of looking at things. But the squad there was magnificent. And, you know, Roy Keane then joined in January for Manchester United. I then played with the likes of Thomas Gravesen, who was an absolute nutcase, Kenny Miller, Gary Cordwell. So, you know, Scott Brown, who ended up being a manager at Fleetwood, I think he's now managing back in Scotland. So, you know, the squad of players that I played with and the teammates I was with was a great experience. It didn't work out as well as I wanted it to. I think injuries played a massive part in that. A few personal issues before I left, which was difficult for me. So timing, it was difficult. But from what I can take from that now, I've learned a lot from that, which has helped me in my life kind of going forward today.
You'd have been relatively young when you went up to Celtic then, 22, something like that. You've got the, like you've just said, a a list of unbelievable players. Roy Keane particularly stands out as well. What were they like with you, like in training behind the scenes? Are they, a young lad coming up from Brighton, were they good or was it intimidating and difficult? Or how did you find that kind of moving from a Brighton to like a Champions League type team with all those big players?
Yeah, it was. I mean, the club surprises you more of how big a club can actually be. I remember signing and I was in a hotel in the middle of Glasgow and I just went out for some food the first night, or maybe the second night. And you kind of go into that town, into the middle of Glasgow, and you get recognised straight away. It's kind of, it was quite, I didn't even think about it. And you get in a taxi and then the taxi driver recognises you quite quickly. And you go into certain restaurants that are owned by Rangers fans and you can't go in there. But if you go into a Celtic one, you can't bloody pay for the bill because they won't take your money. So there's just all these, it's just mental. And when they say it's a goldfish bowl, it is massively. And you've got to be careful where you go out, certain areas that you have to go into. But the players were great. I mean, I think the biggest thing I had to adjust to that these are not the players now that I've seen on the TV and, you know, played on FIFA and stuff. You know, these are now my teammates that, you know, I'm playing with. And, you know, John Hartson was a massive help for me. He really, really looked after me in terms of telling me what to do and kind of how to act. And, you know, Neil Lennon was a great help. Chris Sutton was difficult, but he was one of those testing people that wanted to test you and kind of see where you were at mentally. But overall, at the end of the day, they're your teammates and they're not there to try and catch you out or anything else like that. I felt that I was really well looked after by the players. I think the manager could have helped me a little bit more in terms of the things that would help me kind of benefit into the club. You know, financially, you go from X to Y and it's just a completely different thing. You know, I kind of make the joke that I left Brighton in a Ford Fiesta and arrived in an X5. It's kind of the change in lifestyle that you have is what it was. And I don't think I was quite prepared for that side more than anything.
Can I just quickly come in? So when you moved to Celtic, obviously one of the most challenging things about that would be you've basically gone from being a first team player to a kind of a fringe player. And what your Wikipedia makes clear is that in your second start, you got man of the match against Motherwell, which I think proves like an unbelievable mentality because you know that your place is on the line and you're fighting for basically game time. Just what I want to know basically was how difficult is it for a player who knows they're not going to start every game and then they'll come in and they basically know unless they give a man of the match performance, they might not play the next game.
Yeah, it's really tough. And one of that was one of the reasons why I said no, but originally, because I didn't think I'd play. And that was the kind of conversation that I had with Gordon in Brighton that, you know, financial, the money side of it was mentioned last. That, to me, you can earn as much money as you want. If you're not playing, then that wasn't what my mentality was about at that stage. And, you know, I said to Gordon, he kind of looked at me and I was a bit hesitant. He said, like, tell me what's wrong. And I was like, well, the only thing I'm worried about is I'm not going to play. I said, I'm looking at all these players in front of me and I can't see myself. I said, I don't mind if I have to wait a little bit, but I just said, I can't see myself playing. And he just went, look, I need a right back. So you're going to go in as my number one right back and then you're going to go in at centre half. He told me that Boba Baldé was leaving the club at the time. And he goes, I promise you now, this is what's going to happen. And I looked at him, I said, you promised me? And he went, yes. And I said, well, I'll be an idiot to turn you down. And unfortunately, that didn't quite happen. And, you know, my first five games, I played four different positions. I played right back, centre half, centre midfield, centre forward. You know what I mean? I just kept playing in different positions, which is not easy to settle into. When you played out a position for Brighton when they need you to, it's not the end of the... When you play out a position at a club like Celtic, it's, you know, you imagine someone like Harry Maguire playing up front for Man U. It just doesn't work. And I felt changing positions left, right and centre was always going to be difficult. And you're right. And then all of a sudden, you've got that added pressure that you've got one game now to prove yourself. And then I had another game after that and then you get dropped. So it was difficult. It wasn't relaxing. That if I had 15 games in a row and I said, look, I wasn't good enough, then I could probably accept that. And I'm not saying, I've never said afterwards that I would be a player that would have played 450 games for Celtic, but I'd never really, really, really felt that I got a fair opportunity of a regular run of games, if that was 5 or even 10 at that stage. It was always like one here, one there, and this and that, really, which is impossible to kind of gain any momentum.
Since the rise of kind of football podcasts, you see quite a lot of ex-pros come out and speak about their time in football, and you just touched on it a little bit there. There sounds like there's quite a lot of false promises that are made in sort of the initial conversations that players have with clubs to get them there, and then it can be a completely different experience when you are there. Is that difficult then to have the respect for the manager or want to play for them? Is it a mindset thing where you just got to think, well, I've got to do the best I can in it? If Gordon Strachan puts you up front, you've got to do your best? Or is there a point where you switch off and think, no, I've got to get out, I've got to get off here, because it's never going to happen? And then does it leave a sour taste in the mouth? Because it, from a lot of the stories that I've heard, and kind of sounds like a little bit's happened to you there at Celtic, it sounds like it would leave a bit of taste.
It does a little bit, because people have an opinion that, you know, you're crap and you didn't deserve that opportunity. And that's the kind of thing that leaves a little bit of a sour taste in your mouth. And I never really spoke about it for about 10, 15. I might have been done 10 years. Because if you leave a club and you completely slate the club, then everyone's just, oh, it's sour grapes. And, you know, he's having a go at this and having a go at that. But there's a lot more to it. And when you're kind of, now you're in your early 40s and you've kind of been retired a long time, you can speak about it differently and you can kind of be a bit more honest and a bit more diplomatic about it, really. But that is just football in general. Unfortunately, I've had managers that promise you stuff and they don't. And I never quite understand why managers still don't have that gut of just saying, you're not good enough, this has been a mistake, I'm sorry, we'll try and move on and make it the best move or something to move you on. They always seem to have an excuse. And, you know, working with young players these days and me working in the game now, it hasn't really changed. There's still an element of the manager saying things that you want to hear, but don't ever hold their hands up and just say, look, I've got it wrong. It's not worked out. I had a Gus Poyet at Brighton further on in my career. I had a little bit with Terry at Yeovil towards the end. It's always been the nature of the beast in the game, and I still don't know why, because we're grown adults, you know. We'd rather be told the truth and then you can just move on. Not every signing's going to be right, and sometimes it's not bad of a manager to say, look, it just hasn't worked out, I'm sorry, etc., and you move on. But they seem to kind of come up with all these excuses that are not really factual or right. It is difficult, but unfortunately that's just the nature of the beast, and you kind of gain a bit of a thicker skin moving on.
So I want to come on in a bit to your time at Yeovil, Adam, but in between that, you had this stint at Coventry, Colchester and back to Brighton. How was the transition sort of from leaving Celtic, where, as you alluded to there, maybe had some false promises, didn't play as much games as you'd have liked, and I know there were injuries as well. What was your time like in between that sort of stint between Yeovil and Celtic at those three teams?
Yeah, it was difficult because... It was difficult because your confidence is not, and you probably don't realise that at the time. And, you know, moving all the time doesn't help. You're kind of going from a house into a flat, and then you kind of move, you're leaving, you know, if you've got a girlfriend or a partner up there, they're stuck. It's very, very difficult to kind of get really, really settled. And then, you know, Mickey Adams was my manager at the time, and then he then got the sack, and then Ian Dowie came in, and then Ian Dowie was, he then moved on, and then it was just never easy to kind of get settled. And then, in fairness, the only honest manager that there was Ian Dowie. When he told me about the Coventry takeover, he said, I can't sign you because there's going to be no money. And I thought he was kind of saying something like that, to kind of just make it an easy pass out. And then he was telling the truth, because Coventry, well, you can see what happened to Coventry or what happened later on. And then, you know, then all of a sudden, Colchester's another move, which a team that just didn't really get going. You have a relegation there, and then you go back to Brighton, and then the second time you go back, it was just a really difficult few years, because, you know, I broke my arm at Coventry, and then I did my knee at Coventry at the start of the season. And then I broke my arm at the end of the season. Colchester, I never really got going. And then, you know, Brighton was difficult to have that same effect as I did in the first time there. So it was a difficult period of my career, which you learn from. But it wasn't ideal from where I was before I moved to Celtic to where I was at that time.
You mentioned Gus Poyer there. I remember that Brighton team. Yeovil were in League One at the same time, and they won the league at one point, didn't they? He done well there, and I remember Glenn Murray, and I think Elliot Bennett had a really good season there as well. I remember them being formidable one year, maybe Liam Bridcut as well. Is that difficult too when you've got a manager that may, I'm not saying you didn't with Poyer, but I can imagine if you weren't in his plans, probably not the easiest manager to get on with. Is it difficult then seeing them go on and do well when you've maybe got that kind of sour taste in your mouth, thinking you haven't been given the chance or it's not quite worked for you?
Yeah, it is what it is. I think the way that I saw myself come back to Brighton for the second time, you know, I thought it would be a lot longer. I thought Mickey Adams being my first manager that I played under, I'd signed for him four times now. So I'd go back, then you're made captain of the club. But, you know, I was listening to Joe Hart's podcast the other day with High Performance when he was talking to Jake about when Guardiola came in. It's just like some managers have an opinion on you. But again, with Gus moving me on, there was still an element of you're still in my plans. And even though he took the captaincy off me without telling me, I found that out in the paper rather than him telling me. And then I finished the season really, really well there. I actually played a lot of games under him. I got sent off at Leeds. And a lot of people thought that was a turning point for me, that if I'd have finished the season well, then I maybe would have got another year. But he signed Gordon Greer. He was the one who came in to replace me. And, you know, that's football. I can't help a manager's decision and what he makes. But you know, I felt that I was good enough to be there because I'd shown in those 6 months while I was playing for him that I was one of the most consistent players there. But, he wants to go in a different direction. And I don't really have a bit of taste in my mouth of what happened afterwards. You know, the club's in a really, really good place now in the Premier League. And I will say this, Gus was probably the manager that kind of got the ball rolling a little bit in terms of the style of play. And, you know, as you mentioned there, that Brighton team that won that League One was an unbelievable side. You know, Elliot Bennett came and did really well. Liam Bridcut was there, Will Buckley. So that was a really, really good squad of players that, you know, quite rightly won the league and got promoted. But yeah, not really disappointed in terms of having that sour. It was just, again, you just want that bit of honesty where it just kind of went on and on and on that you thought you got a chance and then ends up not happening for you.
On to happier times then. We've seen that you said that you loved your time at the Mighty Glovers. What was it about Yeovil that you enjoyed so much? Was it the playing squad, the manager, the environment, just the general feel around the club?
I just think it was everything. I think it was a time in my life where I probably just needed to enjoy my football again. I knew Nathan Jones. I knew Ben Roberts. Nathan was a big influence on my career the first time round at Brighton. He kind of got me into a setting in my life where training was good. He did a lot on, you know, he did a lot of on his own with me. So when I moved down there, he took me under his wing massively. And I just think I just needed to play football and enjoy my football again. And I will say this now, and I'm not just saying it because I'm on this. It's for the year I was there, it's probably the happiest I ever was because, you know, I'll say this nicely, financially, it was probably one of the weaker contracts that I was on. But at that stage of my career, I just wanted to enjoy football again. I love Yeovil as a place. My wife and I, we've got a flat down in Sherborne. I still see Don Gibson, the dentist guy, every 6 months. I still go down and see him to get my teeth sorted out. I'm seeing him again in August. So, I've always had a real close affection for the club. Everybody that worked behind the scenes. And then there was a really good bunch of lads there. You know, Craig Alcott became a very good friend of mine, Andy Welsh. But I really liked the simplicity of life down there. I just absolutely loved it. I lived in a little village called Tintinhull on the outskirts of Yeovil, and I just loved it there. I don't know what it was. It was the people, but I just think it. I give credit to Terry. He just gave me my confidence back again of believing that you're a good player, because in those 2 or 3 years, your confidence has been knocked a little bit. and playing for Yeovil kind of just gave me that confidence back again.
Is it with confidence issues in players, is it just as simple as a manager basically like taking you to one side and just saying, look, you're a really good player, Adam. You'll have a proper chance for me. You've got the next 10 games to prove that you can get back into the swing of things. Is it as simple as that? Because we always talk about confidence in players, and sometimes it just takes for a striker, a goal that goes off his knee, and then all of a sudden he goes on a run. I guess it would be slightly different for a defender, but what was the sort of the switch, do you think, for you in that Yeovil move?
Well, I knew in many ways that we wouldn't have the biggest of squads. So it was a confidence boost that, and he said to me that, you know, Paul Huntington would come in alongside me. And I played a trial game against Swansea, and then I played against the Manchester United youth team, as it was then, got myself a goal. And, you know, he said to me, nicely, he said, look, this is the money that we can offer you. It's not great, but what I can guarantee you is first team football. You will start the season, and it's up to you to prove your worth. And that's all. If I'd have got that Celtic and started the first 10 games, then, you know, the career may have ended up slightly differently. But that's kind of what I needed at that stage. I couldn't go through another, well, you need to prove yourself again and you need to do this. He was just like, look, I know what's happened before. And I know Nathan Jones and Ben were huge influences to say, look, there's a good player in there. It's just his confidence has been knocked. And, you know, Terry being a defender as well, I think always helps as a manager playing your position. You can work on your game a little bit. But it was just that belief factor of, do you know what? We want you to come here. We believe that you can help the squad and help the team and help the youngsters. So it can be as simple as that. But it's just like, if I hadn't started the first game of the season against Leyton Orient, then I'd have been back to square one again of a false promise. But, you know, fortunately, you know, Terry kept his word, and I slowly started gaining confidence again and you know, had a solid season.
What was he like as a manager, Skivo, Adam? Because obviously he's a club legend for us, one of the best players we've ever had, one of the most influential. And it's easy to forget, he's actually at Wimbledon now with Johnny Jackson, I think, is in the system. But it's easy to forget now that we're in non-league again, that he actually done two or three seasons for us, probably had over 100 games in charge for Yeovil in League One, which is a good standard to be managing at. And obviously he came straight into it, I think, after Russell Slade left. So what was he like, particularly as someone that's been at obviously massive clubs like Brighton, but particularly Celtic? Did you rate him?
Yeah, I did. I didn't, he wasn't, I'm trying to be respect. I think that he needed Darren Way to do the coaching. I think he needed Nathan to help him with the coaching. But I think managing-wise, he was very, very good. And, you know, I've got to give him credit, because when you see Yeovil season after season, it's new squad after new squad after new squad. And, you know, if you think about the loan signings that he got right, I think, remember Stephen Colker. I think when I think about Luke Freeman, I think about Luke Ayling. Yeah. You know, these players that you go and find in the loan system, that's not anything by, you know, that's a good manager that sees that potential, you know, that he got right. I think I always, you know, I've done a lot of the National League now with TNT. So I know working on small budgets isn't easy. It's a very, very difficult thing to do. And I think he was very, very good at kind of that team spirit. I think, you know, he kind of wanted to be one of the lads, but he knew he had to draw a line a little bit somewhere where he couldn't do that. But, you know, he'd be very open if, you know, I'll say it nicely, if he saw you in a pub, I don't think he'd be like, how dare you? He'd probably join you for a drink. You know what I mean? Is that,
yeah.
He was that kind of manager. But I think sometimes when you're a club legend and you sometimes try too hard for the club sometimes and things like that. But I didn't have a problem with Terry. I just felt that he was a very upfront manager. Didn't reinvent the wheel in anything that I didn't know already. But I just felt that he had good control of the group. And I think he was a very, very good man manager that spoke to players a lot of the time. He knew that he couldn't afford to lose too many players in terms of confidence and losing the spirit of the squad, because he couldn't go out and sign a load of players, you know. So I think what I liked about it, he trusted the senior players in the team to take control of the dressing room. And then, listen, he would lose it sometimes when he had to. But I found him thoroughly enjoyable to play under. I you know, I'm got a bad word to say about him.
You mentioned Nathan Jones a couple of times, obviously from your Brighton days and at Yeovil. Obviously, he's gone on. I know he's at Charlton now, but his job at Luton was unbelievable. A couple of disappointing stints at Stoke and Southampton in between. But could you see that then? Because I can't remember if Jonesy was still playing or whether he was the assistant. I think he was the assistant to Skiver, wasn't he, when you were there? Could you see that he had something that might go on and be a little bit progressive in football? Because it's not just he's done well. He did it with a real kind of progressive style, certainly at Luton, going up through the leagues. And obviously, I think Charlton are quite impressed with him now as well, and I'm expecting them to go well this year. Could you see that back then, that he was going to go on and have a good career coaching-wise?
Yeah, he literally ate, slept, breathed football. Like, football was his life. He was... It was his life, and it still is. And I felt really sorry for him when he went to Stoke. I felt really sorry for him at Southampton, because I knew, you know, even when I was at Yeovil, he was coming towards the end of his career. But he still had a few, you know, he was the fittest in the team. You know, he would eat right all the time. And when I said that little stint when I was at Brighton, he literally pulled me aside one day when I was walking in, and he kind of said, "Where are you going?" And I said, "Well, going home." And he said, "No, you're not. You're staying with me now." And it was me, Dan Harding, and another player called Charlie Oakway. And he then said, "Right, you're doing extra with me after training." So I did that. And then he goes, "You're going to have your lunch." And then you're going in the gym with me in the afternoon. And I just remember, we just worked and worked and worked and worked, and small things like I couldn't even like do 3 pull-ups, and then all of a sudden you're kind of doing 4 sets of 20. Like, he changed my game completely, and I could see that. And he really did study the game. And I think even when I was there, he was going out to Barcelona and to Europe. So during the summer, he would go on these coaching courses in Europe and really studied the game. And, you know, he's fluent in Spanish, which I don't think many people know about. He's addicted to the game. So I thought you'd be a coach more than the manager, if that was my honest opinion. But there was no surprise, the job that he's done at Luton in particular. I just feel sorry for him that people kind of look at that stint at Southampton and probably, you know, banish a good person. He, Yeovil fans will see, you know, he gave everything for the badge every single week. I can't. He kind of took it personally when they lost, and if people were mucking around, he would pull him into gear. So, seeing where he's gone to now, and Ben Roberts is another one. You know, he was a goalkeeping coach at Brighton. He's gone to Chelsea. Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised one day if he's a goalkeeping coach for England. That's how good he was as a person.
So when you were there, and you just touched on some of the loan signings that we had. We had the likes of Ryan Mason, John Obika, Andros Towns on there as well. But Laurie's a Leeds fan, and probably pound for pound, one of our most successful loanees, Luke Ayling. At the time, signed a young lad from Arsenal as a centre midfielder, has gone on to have a great Premier League Championship career at right back. When you get those young lads in from like the Premier League academies on loan, do you notice a difference and see that they've got it, and maybe it's about going to a club to become a man from playing sort of academy football? Do they stand out, and do they look like people are going to go on and have top careers?
Yeah, Luke Freeman and Luke Ayling. If we're talking about Luke Ayling, he was just a really, really good kid at the time at 18 years old. I just felt it's all about learning the game, and it's kind of learning to grow up quite quickly at 18 years old. And I think those environments are valuable for any young players. And I know the academy system is there for these players, but you know, I just say go and play in the National League and go and learn your craft and go and learn your trade. And I'm not sounding like a dinosaur, but go and get kicked and kind of learn about winning and losing and kind of playing for 3 points and, you know, people that need to win and stuff. It's a completely different mindset. But Luke was a really good lad, Luke Ayling. So if you would have said to me he's gone on to have the career that he had, I don't, you know, you can never say that at that age. But what you can say is that he was a really, really good lad. He was eager to learn. You know, he had that stutter at the time, which he kind of struggled with, which, you know, that's not easy in a footballing dressing room to kind of have that. And I'm not saying I took him under my wing, but when someone's good and you kind of see potential, it'd be wrong of me as a senior pro to kind of ignore it and not help him. And I didn't see him as a right back, but you know, you don't play for Leeds and you don't move to Middlesbrough and clubs like that if you haven't got something about you, even being at Arsenal, you know. But again, I think Yeovil at that stage, I think Dan Byrne come on loan, didn't he? Kind of all these players that it's invaluable, and Yeovil have made a really, really good reputation of finding these loan players and setting them up to go on to massive careers, which is a compliment to the club, is a compliment to everybody that works there, and it's a compliment to the squad, the players that, that look after them. But Luke's a great lad, and I love seeing Luke doing well. When I was doing TV games for Leeds, I'd always go down and say hello to him, and he was always very complimentary and always had time to speak to me, which was always nice. And you know, he said on a couple of occasions, you know, thank you for the time, and you know, the kind of, not the advice I give him, but just kind of just looking after him and putting an arm around him.
Before we move on to the sort of punditry stuff and that side of things, you mentioned you thought Nathan Jones may be more of a coach than a manager back then. You also mentioned Adam Hinzelwood, who's at York now, who I saw a lot of his Worthing side last year, who are unbelievable, but he strikes me as very much an on-the-grass kind of coach-type manager. I think there's a big movement in football at the moment where you're seeing these kind of progressive coaches get the top jobs more than your old-school managers. Like your Harry Redknapps and your Sam Allardyces. Now you get, and I know Plymouth appointed one last year, Millwall did. Sometimes they don't work out. Sometimes they do, Kieran McKenna being one of them. Do you see that change? Do you think there's a change in what teams are looking for, and it's more about the style of play and the coaching rather than the old school boss that sits there and lets the coaches do it?
Yeah, I think so. You know, where I live now in Brighton, the new manager has come, I think he's younger than all of us. It's like he's 30 years old or something stupid, but the game is slowly changing. I do see that definitely. But I think there's still two ways of looking at it. There's still an element of overplaying and kind of overcomplicating the stuff that's now coming through the academy systems of 6-year-olds playing out from the back. You know, it starts that early, and that's kind of the way to play now. And teams don't want to be seen as a long ball team anymore. And, you know, the old school manager, you know, is kind of being seen now, slowly coming a little bit into extinct. You know, sometimes when, you know, things hit the fan, you call Neil Warnock to come in and help you still. Do you know what I mean? So there's still an element of that kind of manager to do that. But I still feel that there is an element of the old school manager that still needs to be there, because the principles of football never change. And, you know, the respect in the game is still never changed, even though the style is changing slightly. Listen, when teams are losing, they still launch it. England scored the over egg kick from a long throw. Do you know what I mean? There's still that element of that game still in there. But I do understand, because it's the old school manager may not understand the new style of player that's coming through. It's not only the way that they play; it's the way that they act. It's the way they communicate. You know, there's a lot more to dealing with a footballer now than what there was probably once upon a time. And I don't know if the modern club sees an old school manager kind of taking that role and kind of progressing younger players through with that old school mentality. But as long as they change with it, but I can certainly understand why teams are now looking at a manager, because a lot of it's stat based. A lot of it is how you present yourself. It's a massive part of the game now. So I still feel that there's an element of that. If you're a manager and you're that mentality, as long as you've got a coach beside you that can kind of coach the players and have that mindset, then I still think the balance can still be there. But I'm not surprised now that teams are looking at different styles of managers, and managers are getting younger and younger, getting into the game.
And Adam, you've touched on a few people there who've gone on to be successful coaches that you've either played with or played under. Obviously, your career probably cut short by injuries. Was there a time in between what you're doing now where you thought actually you want to do your coaching badges and go as a first team coach in the pro game or in the sort of top of the non-league stakes and try and work your way up as a head coach or a first team coach?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think in hindsight, I wish I'd have maybe handled it a little bit differently. You kind of, when I was younger, you know, the PFA used to come in and talk about taking your level ones and your level twos, and I'd just be like, I'll just go home and play Call of Duty or something. I didn't really have that mindset of, you know, what do I need my badges for at 21? It's just the naivety of a young player then shouldn't have done that. And I think my biggest regret, when I was at Bristol Rovers and I knew in January of 2013 that my career was over and I still had 6 months to sort myself out. And I think maybe during that time I could have said to Mark McGee, who was the manager then, you know, can I start working with the youth team? I knew my career was over then, but I just went to the gym and I went home and I didn't really prepare myself. I maybe could have done some media within that time and kind of dip my toe in the water in terms of that. So I didn't really have a plan B out of the game. But I wish now that where I sit today and when I speak to young players and I, you know, just go and do your coaching badges, just get it under your radar. Go and learn something else, you know, outside of football, because you never know what's going to happen around the corner, especially now the turnaround, the amount of players now that you can find in the game. It's just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. To, you know, your longevity of your career is very, very difficult. So I wish I'd have probably been a bit more streetwise with that. But again, you learn those lessons, and, you know, being a dad of two now, you kind of pass that on to them to kind of have things in a backup. You want to go and do something, brilliant, but just make sure you've got something in the background. If it doesn't work out, then you can fall into that.
Can I just quickly ask about the injuries, if that's possible? I just want to know how challenging it is as a professional athlete to get injured and overcome those injuries constantly, and then obviously have your career cut short because of like the injuries.
Yeah, it's really tough. My first injury for Brighton was in 2005. I just tore my cartilage and I missed the last two games, but then I had a big injection to play in the last game, and then I had an operation on it. And, you know, listen, I was a player that would, I couldn't say no. It wasn't in my DNA to go and do that. Breaking your arm is just one of those things that happen. I made my debut for Coventry and did my PCL within 30 seconds. I ripped my calf when I was at Celtic. It's just kind of the constant. And even at the end with my knee at Bristol Rovers, it was just, I was in so much pain. The last game I ever played was at Wimbledon. I should never have played that night, but the team was struggling. Manager needed players. I knew there was players in the treatment room that weren't really injured. They were kind of hiding. And I just stuck myself out. And I think, you know, my advice to players these days is you've got to look after yourself. And I probably at that stage had that old school mentality of give me a couple of tablets, give me an injection, I'll go out and play. And it was almost seem a bit heroic. And, you know, it's not, because at the end of the aftercare, when you finish, none of the clubs reach out to you and say, listen, thanks for everything you've done. Do you want to come here and help? And, you know, you don't get that aftercare, even if you've done well at a club in particular. This, you know, they go through so many players and stuff. But, you know, I think the PFA can maybe do a little bit more with the aftercare of players that have retired. But the finances are maybe not there, or the setup, or the way that the pyramid works for players that do retire through injury and through other things. That I think the mental health side, I think they're getting better with that, that they see that as a big issue, which is totally understandable. But they don't seem to, I don't think they have the care and attention for people that have had serious injuries. And I still struggle with it now. But it's tough. It's really tough. But you can't change it now. You just have to learn from it.
So the punditry then, Adam, I watch all the National League stuff on BT, and obviously you're synonymous with that. How did that start? Was it were you approached by BT Sport to come and start doing National League games, or did you do bits and pieces here and there and then an opportunity arose? How did you get into kind of that avenue rather than obviously the coaching stuff? What was the sort of spark that led you into the media side of things?
I think sometimes it's a little bit of luck in your life. It's like a sliding doors moment. My brother knew a guy called Grant Best, who was at Sky for many years. He went to school with my brother, and I knew Grant since I was about the age of six. I, funnily enough, did my work experience at Sky with Grant. So I'd always had an interest in the media side and things like that. And then I spoke to a couple of people in the industry, and one guy in particular just said, have you spoken to Grant Best? And when I looked up Grant Best online, I saw that he was working for ESPN in America. And then I spoke to him again, and he said, no, he's now the head of BT Sport. So basically making all the big decisions. And I knew Grant quite as well, because when I used to play on Sky, he would then be the director or the producer. So I'd see him then and things. So I hadn't spoken to him for a few years, and I managed to find his number from somewhere, and I rang him and he picked up the phone, and I basically said what had happened. And at that stage, I'd rung a little bit too late that the National League were starting in a week's time or something, and they hadn't had their setup in terms of the pundits, but they were going with Steve Bauer and James Beattie with the co-com and the commentator. And I think the one bit of advice that Grant gave to me, which I'll always be forever grateful for, he just said to me, go and learn to be a co-commentator, because I think he could see the way that the game was going, that you need more co-coms on games. But he could see the way that TV was going, that football was just going to explode and there'll be game after game after game. And you can kind of be a little bit synonymous as a co-com, whereas if you're a pundit, your face fits that game. Do you know what I mean? So,
yeah.
And then about November time, James Beattie got the Accrington job in League Two. And in that time, I did a few bits and bobs for Sky. I did a few bits for Talk Sports, and was just kind of... And then I got a little gig at BBC Sussex, which was a really good learning curve for me. A gentleman called Johnny Cantor was the main commentator. So I was commentating on Brighton games every week, which at that stage, Brighton weren't doing very well. So the good thing was there was that I learned so much so quickly, because when you do phone-ins, when you're losing, fans phone in and have a good moan up. When teams are winning, it's boring. It's like, well done. Okay, yeah, well, we haven't really got nothing to moan about. Where if teams are doing badly, he needs to go, what's going on about, why isn't he playing, and this. And you learn a lot quite quickly. So in about November time, James got the Accrington job, and Grant rang me and said, look, there's a chance here for you. And nicely, he said, I've not stuck my neck out on the line, but in TV, they sometimes want a name, maybe an ex-England player, an ex-Premier League player. But because he knew me for a long, long time, he knew that I would go away and learn the trade and go and learn to be a good co-com. And I know he kind of stuck his nut. I think the bigwigs were like, we want somewhere else. And he said, no, we're going to go with Adam. And that was it, really. And as you say, the rest is history there. And it's been 10 years ever since.
So with obviously the National League, Adam, I know you've done some stuff with Brighton as well, which we'll come on to. But is it a case of the same as like a player where you want to co-com at the highest level or be a pundit at the highest level? Like, are you got interest in moving into like EFL? I know Sky and BT are different providers for that, but would you like to go and do sort of Championship League One and eventually move into the Prem? Or do you think that with punditry, it's about knowing the sort of players and the clubs and having the full knowledge of it? And actually, National League now is almost quite a sexy league, really. A lot of people watch it. A lot of people are watching BT Sport, and therefore you can grow and develop with that league.
Yeah, I mean, like anything, I've been there 10 years now. So, I've been on the Champions League. I've been given some Premier League games. I did all of Brighton's Europa League games last season. I've done French for 5 years. I've done Italian. So they do feed you the games that you want. But of course, it's like anything. You get a taste of a Premier League game, you want more. And you know, I do a lot of French. So the French teams in the Champions League, you want to go and do that. But there's a big, you know, roster of people that they look at. Some are under contract, some are not, and you know, some faces fit the bill and some don't. So, but you know, the EFL on Sky is another one that you look at, which is a big opportunity. But you know, when you're working for one company, it's difficult to go and then kind of sleep with the enemy sometimes and go over there. So you've got to be quite careful in terms of that. But you know, like anything, I want to be on the Euros. I want to do the World Cup. You know, I've done the African Cup of Nations. I'm very, very fortunate to be doing the Olympics this summer for Discovery. So that'll be another feather in your cap. But like anything, like I love doing the National League. It's something that I've grown to love. It's a really, really, really good league. And you know, I've met some great people doing it. You know, I've seen Yeovil be there, which has always been nice when they've played in the league. You go to different grounds and stuff, but the level of football, don't get me wrong, when you get given a Champions League game, they're the games that you really, really want to be on. When I went to the Olympic Stadium in Rome in the last season when Brighton played there, that you can't say that if you've got no ambition to get to the very top, then they're the things you want to be doing. But I don't forget what's got me there, and that has been the National League. And as long as they want me to do it, I'll continue to do it. But of course, you always want to progress on. You know, I always want more, and I want to be doing big FA Cup games, and that's why ITV came in. And you know, I got a good one last year, Liverpool v Wolves, which was a good reward. But it's a tough business because everyone wants to do it. But hopefully now, being doing it 11 years, that I've kind of grown to be a decent co-com and people like listening to me. And then you build a relationship with Adam Summerton that people then seem to like, which always makes life a lot easier. So, yeah, of course, there will be times now I want to be going for the much bigger games on a regular basis.
This is what I always think, right, with punditry in particular, but also co-coms. It's always ex-footballers, which is fine because you've got the knowledge of the game, you can share your insight and stuff like that. But actually, particularly in punditry, actually standing in front of a camera and speaking eloquently and on point and to time next to someone like, I don't know, Jake Humphries or Matt Smith, whoever it is, who's obviously a professional in that game, that's got to be pressure because it's not a skill set you've got from football, is it? Speaking in a certain way in that regard on telly in front of hundreds of thousands, millions of people, particularly if you've got people that have put their neck on the line to get you a job in the first place, that must be quite challenging because it's a complete, although you're speaking about something you know, the actual job you're doing is completely different to being a footballer. Do you feel that pressure, like stood in front of the camera? Is it nerve-wracking? I'm sure if you've done it for a decade now, maybe not so much, but at the start particularly, was that challenging?
It's because you don't get training and you learn on the job. I mean, I remember doing the Channel 5 Football League show and I'm not going to lie, I've still not watched it back from the first. It was just a nightmare because I'd never worked in a studio. I'd never done live TV and it was just an absolute nightmare. I couldn't, you don't really do many rehearsals and you kind of just learn on the job. Like no one gave me a microphone and said, right, come and let's commentate on some games and let's go through some of the things. You know, I learned on the job and I think what helped me was that I asked questions afterwards. You know, I remember the first game I did, it was Barnet v Cambridge and Kev Evans was our producer. He came out and he said, oh, well done, mate. And da 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 da. And I said, great. I said, but I must have done some things wrong. And like Steve Bauer was huge because he would tell me afterwards, like quite big things. Like he goes, look, when the ball's out wide and you think cross is going to come in, you've got to stop talking because I can't then jump in. And they just give you constructive advice. And I think they want to help you when, you know, you come in and you've done your research for the game and they get annoyed sometimes when they, you know, you work with certain pundits that just don't do any research and they just turn up and do the job. But it's not easy because people just look at you and you're kind of learning on the job and that's the difficult thing. And I did some coaching with Matt Smith a little while ago and we did an interview scenario and it was a nightmare because he told me to talk for 5 minutes and I went for about 9.5 minutes. I didn't realise the timing of it. And he was then teaching me when we do like, when you go to a pundit and you have to do like a 30-second count back. And he was just teaching me little things of the trade of, I mean, he's doing it a long time now. They're getting slightly better with the coaching, but you don't get coached. And yeah. I think that's where people think, you know, when you see someone on the telly nowadays that, you know, when they throw people in, you can get found out. And I feel sorry for them because you ask for a job and they don't really look into how long have you been doing this for? How much experience have you got? It's almost like, great. Well, he or she can have done it. Oh, great. They play for that. Let's just get them on. And they don't always have the tools and the know-how to actually communicate because Nasser Hussain said something. And I always remember I listened to him once and he was talking about the third eye when he was talking about spin bowling. He said like Shane Warne was in the seat next to him and he felt really under pressure. He said like, if I can analyse it in a way that I understand, then people at home would understand it. Even I'm not a spin bowler. You know, I think Martin Brundle's the best co-com out there in the Formula One. I think he's amazing. And you don't need to be a Formula One fan to understand the tactics of it. He will explain it to the simple person that's never really watched a race. And I think that's what's helped me. I've gone out and just learned from so many different sports. And, you know, someone said something, Ali McCoy said something the other day, I'm going to nick it and I'm going to use it this season for something that he said. So I'm always learning. I'm always listening all the time to try and be better. I'm not one of those ones that just go home. I analyse myself. I listen back to myself and think I should have done better there. And hopefully that's probably why I've done okay out of the game because I've always just wanted to improve.
And looking ahead to the National League, obviously going to cover that this season again, Adam. Yeovil in it, won National League South. Not got the Wrexhams or Notts Counties of the previous year in Chesterfield last season. Looks wide open to us. What's your thoughts on the season ahead?
Yeah, it's always a fascinating league to cover. I'm really pleased that Yeovil are back in it. I panic massively when teams get relegated because you never know when you're going to see them again. And I did the Wrexham game last season for ITV when they played them in the FA Cup, and I could see a really good squad of players there. And, you know, Mark was doing a really, really good job. And, you know, it was a good side. And, you know, I speak to people in National League South, and it's pleasing to hear that, you know, they talk about Yeovil in terms of the job that Mark. I just panicked massively that where that club was once upon a time, being relegated, you just think, I'm never going to see them again. And I don't have favourites. And listen, when you've been at a club a little bit, and you kind of, I do have a soft spot for them. But to see them back, but I think always a good, I think what's helped this year, the two that have been relegated aren't Sutton of use to the National League. But I think Barnet will probably start as favourites. We'll wait and see what happens with Southend, because that's always just turmoil there. And I don't think the takeover still happened. And then you'll get clubs like Rochdale who were solid last year, but Oldham are still in there. You never know how they're going to do. But I think touch wood, that I think Yeovil will be okay. But the thing I love about this league is just the unpredictability of it all, that there's never, apart from the Wrexham one where they won it, that's for the 10 years that I've done it, I think I've ever called it once, apart from Wrexham, when I said Leyton Orient would win it. In 10 years, I've actually got it right. There's always, you know, I didn't think Macclesfield would win it. I didn't think Cheltenham would win it once upon a time. I didn't think Barnet would win it. So it's a very, very, very difficult league to predict, but a league that always has great stories, you know, good young players coming through, and, you know, some big teams down there, which is great.
Yeah, I agree. And I do want to get a prediction out of you for the season. I know you just said Barnet, but maybe someone out of left field, because it is an unpredictable league, particularly with no Wrexhams and the, you know, such like in the league. I fancy Yeovil to do well this year. I've obviously watched every game in the National League South last year. And by the way, that's a much better league than I thought it was going to be.
That's a really good league.
Although there aren't massive clubs in the National League at the moment, and like you said, the teams that have come down aren't huge ones, there does seem to be more money floating around in the National League. You see more and more. Forest Green have just come down this year, and they've gone and signed a couple from Cheltenham that they wanted to keep. But it's not always the favourites to win it. I remember when Yeovil came down 5 years ago from League Two, Barrow went and won the league. No one saw that happening. Harrogate got promoted. No one saw that happening. Is there a team that you saw last season covering it that you think might come out of the pack and surprise a few people? I know you know Adam Hintzelwood at York. Not that that would be a surprise with the money they've got. Is there a team you see doing well other than probably Barnet, who are most people's favourites this year?
Yeah, I mean, Altrincham losing Con Clark was a big loss for them. He was a huge player, but I think Phil's a magnificent manager, and they've got something going about them. Aldershot's another team that I always look at. They've signed really, really well over the summer. They've lost Stokes, they've lost Tollage, but Tommy's a decent manager. And I was at the Non-League Paper Awards, and I sat next to him, and he's quietly confident. Gateshead are always a really, really good footballing side. But again, how they will be affected from last season, I don't know. But, you know, Barnet is strong. I mean, Barnet went and signed early, which I think Dean, even after that Solihull Moors game, was pretty peeved off about it. And straight away, he was out there. I think when you look at, you know, Forest Green, again, they always make out there. They haven't got any money. They spend well. Solihull Moors could be another one. Andy Wing, who was a former teammate of mine. So if I had to pick two again, I'd probably say Altrincham, possibly Aldershot as outsiders, but I think Barnet are the team to beat this season.
And so with that league then, Adam, obviously you'll cover that. Laurie just touched on the National League South, National League North. Are you ever sent to watch any of their games, do any commentary on that? I know sometimes if there's a big game, they might have one on. Do you cover much of that, or that sort of next step down?
Not really, to be honest. I mean, I keep an eye on it just to keep tabs on it. But it sounds naive, but because it's not on my payroll, I don't really watch it. So like French and stuff, but I always keep an eye on the results. You know, I read the non-league paper. I kind of keep an eye on social media and stuff. So, you know, the likes of Tamworth last season and Braintree and Bath and Yeovil and all those teams. Like, I know about it and I know who's doing well stuff, but to try and watch things, I saw Worthing a few times because I live 15 minutes from there. So I go and see them a little bit, and then you kind of see other teams that go there with them. But yeah, of course, I'm keeping an eye on it, but it's not it's not the two leagues that I look out for in terms of watching. But again, when we try and show the games, I think we showed the playoffs last year, and then we showed a couple during the season. So, you know, it's still, we, you know, TNT, they're still trying to give that level of coverage to that level, which is unheard of anywhere around the world, to go and watch sixth tier football and give it the full makeup of what we'll give to a National League game. But I think the North and South, as Laura was saying, is just stronger and stronger and stronger. There's some good teams there. You know, players are even dropping down into National League South and North to play, who are accomplished and very, very good players, and good managers are coming up from there. And it's a really, really competitive league, which is great, because they're coming into the National League now and they're making it stronger, which is fantastic.
Right. And then just one final question on National League, Laura, before we move on. There's obviously four teams that go up from League Two and two come down. And so it seems a really, really difficult league to get out of National League. You have this kind of long playoff process as well. So even if you have a great season, but just kind of get pipped, you've still got to go through that avenue. Are there ever any conversations that you're aware of where that could potentially change, where it could be like a third side go up because of the quality that's in the National League, or even like, you know, if you've got four going up from League Two, maybe four going the other way? Is there ever any conversations about that at a sort of senior level?
I don't know, but I mean, if you get Adam Summerton on this show, he'll talk about this for 18 hours. He'll go to 10 Downing Street about it. He's that passionate about the three up and three down. You know, you only have to see the sides now going from National League into League Two. They go on, you know, we very rarely. I mean, if you think the amount of teams that have been promoted, I think Barnet have been re-relegated, Forest Green and Sutton are the teams I remember that have been promoted and then been relegated back down. But, you know, you go and see Bristol Rovers, you go and see teams like that, they just go from strength to strength. Wrexham, Notts County. So I think there's a case for it, and I've banged on the door about it, but unfortunately it's like turkeys voting for Christmas. The EFL are not going to change that, and there's not a lot the National League can do, which is a real shame, because the National League now is as strong as it's ever been. It's not a league that, you know, where it's part-time. They're full-time sides that are paying decent money, and, you know, you're seeing the likes of Will Grigg and Lee Naylor going from League One down to the National League. You've seen Wrexham, the money's there to do it, you know, and players are dropping down into the, of course it's financially, of course, but it's still a risk to drop divisions and go down there. But I don't think it will happen, but there's no case, it's not a risk to do it, because the teams are comfortable enough to be promoted. It's just, unfortunately, the EFL are going to protect their brand, and the National League are going to be very, very difficult. But for me, I say the two hardest playoff finals are the Championship one into the Premier League and the promotion final into League Two. They're the two hardest games in football, in my opinion, because they mean so much.
Yeah, tell Adam Summerton, if he does want to go to 10 Downing Street, I'll go with him, because I could speak for 24 hours about free going up from the National League. I think it's ridiculous, particularly now Yeovil are in it. But won't keep you too much longer, Adam. But just quickly, as the Euros are on, we noticed you played a few games for Scotland at international level in some capacity. Are you a Scottish man or are you an English man when it comes to football now?
I'm English. I was born in England. It was just around the 2004 season, I was playing really well, and Peter Taylor was the England manager at the time, and I was playing up front for Brighton, and they had like Darren Bent, Dean Ashton, John Stead. And Peter Taylor said to me, look, I can't pick you because you're not a centre forward, but even though you're doing well, et cetera, et cetera. And funny enough, Adam Hinchinbrook got a call up as a defender, and Dan Harding, who was at Brighton at the time, he got a call up as well. And then Mark McGee just said, look, in a roundabout way, have you got any other relatives that you know of that are close enough to kind of make that transition? And I never met her, but my grandma I knew was born in Scotland. And I spoke to my dad that day, and he was like, And then I got a birth certificate. I kind of got the clarification to do it. And then I think about a month later, I was off to Germany on a plane playing for Scotland. So it's kind of like the under 23s. That's what it was. They called it Scotland B, but it was kind of like the in-between of the 21s and the 23s to go into the first team. So they called it Scotland B, but it's the equivalent of what an under 23s is in today's language. But yeah, it was an opportunity. And then when I went to Celtic, it kind of worked in my favour, because being up there and then playing for one of the, well, arguably the biggest club, always helped with that. But yeah, learning the national anthem wasn't the easiest thing to do because I didn't know a single word of it before I played.
And obviously we're at the quarterfinal stages now. I think it's fair to say England have flattered to see so far. But what do you think, looking ahead to the weekend? Sounds like a bit of a formation change, potentially moving back to a back three that you've had success. Do you think that Switzerland obviously going to be a tough game? Do you think England going much further, or do you think Saturday might be the final hurdle?
I'll sit here easily, and Saturday night they're out. There's no... It's been such a disastrous tournament, and it just seems that the manager has now not had that control of the players that he's had maybe for a long time. And it's a natural, you know, it's a natural thing to do, that players will lose confidence in the manager. You see it at club level, and unfortunately at the moment it's happening during a major tournament. But because people see Bellingham and they see Foden and they see Kane, who are these world-class players, at the moment they're not playing to their potential, and the manager has a massive effect on that. I don't care what you say. The first goal that we scored in the opening game, we sat back, and that's always been a massive part of Gareth's makeup. We saw it against Italy, we saw it against Croatia. It's not something that is new to the system. I think the biggest problem that Gareth has got, he's been so loyal to these players that Foden would have been, you know, Guardiola taking Foden out of the team by now. You know, if they're not playing, you haven't got time to be loyal and stuff. And the substitutions, I think, just shows a naivety of, you know, of where he's at. And I've been there myself as playing under managers. When they're seriously under pressure, they don't, it sounds silly, you don't think straight. And you know, what's the point of bringing on a striker for a minute when you're 1-0 down? Who does? Like, there's no sense in it. But unfortunately, that's the manner he's singing. And at the moment, he's now completely ripping up the scrap. He's going to a back three against Switzerland. And it's just an absolute mess at the moment. But ironically, we're in a quarter final. We've got the easiest draw in the world in terms of the teams. We could end up bloody winning it. You know, and that's the ironic thing about it. But listen, I want England to do well. But it's just been a disaster. You know, you could tell even just going into it, it hasn't had that momentum that we've had in the past. You know, I think Bellingham's knackered. I think that Foden, and people forget, you know, his wife's pregnant back in England. You forget those. That's not an easy thing to concentrate on. Yeah, so yeah. You know, I think Kane's tired as well. But no point taking all these players in the squad if you're not going to use them.
Well, I wish we never asked.
Yeah,
I was looking forward to Saturday, thinking it was coming home. But Adam Virgo says it's an absolute mess. But I think you've just encapsulated what most of the country have been thinking for the last couple of weeks. And we've just got to hope that maybe the formation change might spark us into life on Saturday. But I think probably a good way to end, don't you think, lads? Adam has said that we're crashing out of the Euros on Saturday.
There's our big title headline.
That's my Scotsman in me.
Thanks for your time, Adam. Cheers, mate.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Cheers.
Well, lads, that was Adam Virgo then. Laurie, what do you make of that?
Interesting career path. Early retirement for a guy that's 40, early 40s, he's already had a decade in the co-coms and punditry game. I'm glad I asked him about the how different it is actually having to stand up or speak in front of camera, in front of loads of people, because you do forget that, like, even like Gary Lineker and people, like, all these people that have been footballers, like he just said, they're not trained to do anything else. And it's not, remember when we started this podcast, it's not easy even just speaking into a microphone. Like, you get nervous doing that sort of thing. So standing up and speaking in front of the country about football when you've never done it before, and you've probably got someone in your ear saying this, that, and that. I've always wanted to ask someone about that. And he sort of gave quite a good insight into what I thought. And I thought it was interesting how he said, also about on the co-coms, like, is the main commentator will say, look, if the ball goes out wide and it looks like a chance is coming, shut up, because I need to speak. And you forget there's like a dynamic there, and it gives you a little bit more of a appreciation of, like, Tilsley and McCoys, for instance. They just seem so seamless, but they must have to think about what they're doing quite a lot more than just chatting. So, yeah, interesting person to speak to. interesting career, both in the game and off the pitch as well.
Yeah, I completely agree. I've found it so fascinating, sort of the inner workings of a footballer. When we all grew up, our sort of big aim in life was to be a professional footballer, wasn't it? We thought of nothing else, really. And you don't ever think about the stuff that sort of happens in professional football, like managers promising you things and they don't follow through. And I do kind of feel sorry a little bit for the managers. I know they get rubbished, I guess, for basically promising things that they don't keep. But as a manager, surely you have to sort of like grease the wheels of everyone basically to get them on board at the start of the season. You almost have to tell people what they want to hear, which is, it's a double-edged sword because, as Adam's just sort of alluded to and made quite clear, like there's human beings behind those footballers and they find things, it's real tricky to move cities all the time. And those are the sort of things you don't really think about when you're sort of assessing footballers' form, like on this podcast. And
especially in those newer leagues as well. You think that in the Premier League, when you're at the top level, you know, you make a £40 million move and everything's probably dealt for you and you can probably just move your kids into a different private school, fly them across the world. But in those sort of EFL leagues, you're on 1-2 year deals and you might have a deal at Brighton as he had, and then suddenly you're up at Celtic. I know that was obviously a good move, but if you have a family, you've got to move them up there. He then returned into the EFL where he had his spells at like Yeovil, and it's like, oh, you get 1 year at Yeovil and you move your family down and put them into school, and then one school year afterwards you're saying to them, look, we got to move again, I've got a job in Colchester now and we're off to Essex. Like in that lower league, it must be real hard yards, a focusing on having a football career but all the kind of other stuff that goes with it.
Yeah, and that point where he said that he hasn't listened back to his first co-coms, and I was going to jump in then and say, well, I feel exactly the same way because I've not listened back to the first Pyramid podcast, because if I think back to that first Pyramid podcast, Jesus Christ, I was stuttering, I was shitting myself, and that's just talking to you two, my mates. So I can't imagine how nervous he would have been talking to a national audience.
Yeah, not easy. But that, like, the pro game's just ruthless, isn't it? Like he just said, Gordon Strachan said, no, you're going to come in. He said to Gordon Strachan, the reason I don't want to come is because I don't think I'll play. And Strachan's gone, no, you're going to come in at right back because I need a right back. Then you play centre half. He was there 3 years and played 12 games. He's just been lied to. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And then disposed of, basically. And then all of a sudden he's scratching around coming to Yeovil. I know he's gone to Brighton in between with Gus Poyet, not worked out too well, but you end up going to Yeovil. I know it's ended in injury in the end of his career, but like I said, sliding doors moments. There might have been a time when Strachan was convincing him to go to Celtic, that he was getting an offer from Leeds or anyone like that in the Championship, and if he'd gone that way, it might have been completely different. So at least he got that time up with the likes of Roy Keane and Petrov and doubling his heart.
Yeah, that's actually one question I really regret not asking him, because I appreciated that it's his podcast and not his teammates' podcast, but I really wanted to ask him a question about how Roy Keane was on the training ground, because that was just after he left United. So I regret not asking him that, to be honest. But obviously listening back to him, he was brilliantly honest, wasn't he? About his struggles, about his injury struggles, about the mental challenges that comes along with being a professional footballer. So it was a brilliant insight into that and a brilliant insight into the punditry game and the co-coms game, wasn't it?
Yeah, I'm too honest about England.
Yeah, he was too honest about England. I also was a bit shocked because I asked him about whether he regretted not going into sort of first team coaching. And I just thought that would be a foregone conclusion that he'd say no because of the career that he's now having in punditry. He's, you know, making real waves there. But it must be so addictive, that elite level football, because he said he regrets not doing his badges and regrets not looking that. And it's like, this is a guy who gets to be on TV every week. He's getting to go to the Stadio Olimpico and do Brighton versus Roma, cover National League and be the kind of face of that. And yet still, he still has that nagging doubt, I guess, about being involved in elite level football, it must just be so addictive. Yeah. And you can see where pros struggle sometimes.
I feel for him in a way there, because he retired when he was 30. And normally when you get to 30, you've got 4 or 5 years left probably playing at a decent level. But in that time, you're doing your badges and you're thinking about what's next. But he's obviously just had it taken away from him. And he's not kind of had that period to think about it. And that's probably what's left him with a bit of regret. But I'm sure there's lots of people out there would love to have his job on COCOMs and National League and Europa League. I didn't even know he did the Italian and French stuff. So he's got loads of work there. And obviously commentating on football all the time is not a bad job to have, is it? So fair play to him.
Yeah, well, a great guest to have on, boys. I really enjoyed his time. Just hope he's bang wrong about England. 1, 2, 3.